I've been working on upping my game so hard this week.
It looks like it. You shaved.
You did. Yeah, you I did. Shaved. But then
why?
Also, well, why? I was in a civil strife at home. I realized it was time for a bit of a reset.
It was like a dramatic shave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I like surprised her with a beautiful gift. And
yeah.
That kind of thing. And she's like, you look like a child. And I was like, love child. Am I right? And then that's not what I said, but.
I've only shaved once since I've been with my wife because like it totally freaked her out.
Yeah, she wasn't into it.
I thought it was gonna be like, oh yeah, like a new man, but she wasn't. Yeah. She
yeah,
wasn't
that was literally the approach I was going for.
Well, apparently I'm not the only one. Matt. Have you ever done that, Nick?
No, never.
You've never shaved?
Never imagined it even.
Yeah.
My You're destiny, a poet. Isn't imagination like your job?
My destiny is not to be a man child.
I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
I'm Nick Sturm.
And this is The Office Hour.
Oh, that's good. But I listened to a lot of podcasts this week.
Yeah.
I read a lot of stuff. I talked to people. I used words. It's going to be good.
Yeah, it sounds like you're riding a bit of a high right now.
I think so. I haven't taught yet today.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, you can use all of your energy on this, I guess.
Well, what I realized, what a little inside baseball.
baseball? Inside baseball?
A little inside baseball for our listeners. We already recorded this episode and failed.
We're going to do it again.
Yeah, this is round two.
We're going to, as Bill O'Reilly famously said,
do it live.
We'll do it live.
Here he's doing like a podcast in his car now.
Is he really?
Yeah,
they go in his car.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
in his car?
Because he's just a pathetic, broken excuse for a man. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to get political in this one.
Well, I mean, it is appropriate considering the topic of today's show. Yeah, I mean, we've already brought up Bill O'Reilly and insulted him.
Yeah.
So we might as well talk about the culture wars, right?
Yeah, and just to pile on by quoting modern conservative philosophers. what I realized I did the other day that was wrong, to quote the, as I said, modern conservative philosopher Donald Rumsfeld.
The unknown known.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly, that I came in, and academics can do two things pretty well.
Yes.
The known known.
Only two things.
Yeah, exactly. There's the known known, there's the things you know that you know.
Right.
You can talk about those things.
Yeah.
And then there's the known unknown, the things that you know that you don't know. I don't know, like, advanced genetic biology. I don't know that.
Sure.
And that's fine. Academics also need to know the boundaries of what they know.
Right.
But if you don't know what you don't know, then you're getting into some deep waters. And that's what happened to me last time when we did this podcast. I didn't realize that I didn't know what I didn't know.
So the unknown unknown.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. And as old Donnie Rums tells us, that's what we have to worry about.
Right.
So yeah, culture wars.
So that's what we're talking about today. Oh, and by the way, I should say that we have a new co-host, Dr. Nick Sturm, who's here with us. Welcome, Nick.
Yeah, in the unknown, unknown, unknown.
That's me. Exactly. Exactly. Nick is the unknown cube.
Yeah, yeah. The attractive, never shorn beard.
Never, never once. He's the Simpson of our podcast.
You can't tell. I just let my hair down.
Yeah,
he did. He's got an attractive man butt.
So, Toby, tell us a little bit about, you know, what piqued your interest in the culture wars? Why is this a thing that you started thinking about?
Well, two things. One, I saw the word a bunch. It's being used in places like The New Yorker frequently now.
Absolutely.
Which is surprising because it's actually a verbiage that's drawn from both the conservative intellectual tradition and the sort of conservative evangelical tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I had more of just a linguistic nit to pick with it.
Yeah.
That neither of these words works very well.
Uh-huh.
Neither the word culture nor the word war are particularly useful for describing the phenomena that they're trying to talk about in this instance. And so this was the initial rabbit hole that I thought I'd go down, which is the wrong rabbit hole.
Okay.
That I'd talk about war.
Uh-huh.
I dislike the war on drugs. I dislike the war on terror.
Right. Because why... Is it just because it's just a euphemism? That it's not like there's not actually... I mean, the war on drugs, there is actually a war going on.
No,
right?
But there's not.
Well, I mean, if you think about Colombia, or if you think about, like, crack in the 80s, like, I think, you know, there is actual military deployment going on.
Well, I guess. I mean,
if you think about, you know, like, 18-year-old, like, black men, like, going to jail for, like, a handful of pot, like, that, you know, that's sounds rather warlike to me.
Well, right, and so what I'd call a Colombia sort of civil strife and FARC and all that, I'd call that a war.
Okay.
However, I think what the word war does for this particular kind of ideological framework is it allows you to sort of suspend constitutional norms.
Yeah.
It allows you to enter what Hobbes or Carl Schmitt or Agamben call the state of exception.
Uh-huh.
And this is a problem because it allows you to do things like go to war on your own population.
Sure.
You know, now these Muslims are potential terrorists, so we can jail them indefinitely as enemy combatants unattached to a nation.
Well, that's the kind of entire political, like, exigence of calling it a war, right?
Right.
To have it be a call to arms, right?
Right.
Like, those of you who do not like drugs, well, good for you, we're going to war on them, right?
Right. Which is one thing if, you know, I'm going to war on my, you know, extra weight this, you know, this new year or
sure.
whatever. Like, that's
yeah.
one kind of euphemism. But it's another if actual legal definitions begin to be suspended in the face of imagining a situation in a certain way. So the war on terror is a great example of this, Guantanamo
sure.
Bay and all that. Similarly with the war on drugs, where there's a sort of stratification of various kind of punishments you can mete out. We develop this massive prison industrial complex and this sort of thing. In order to kind of covertly grab rights from members of our own nation, who are the people we are hypothetically, scare quotes, going to war with, although once again, not a war. Like, there's not another side here. There's not, like, a competing national interest or ideologies. You're actually just stealing rights from your own people and then using this kind of state of exception idea to call it a war and make it okay.
Right.
So I was like, that's the problem. That's not the problem.
What's the problem?
I'm still not certain.
Okay.
There are people who spend their whole careers, the two of you, I'm going to draw on, obviously, in this podcast, because I think you actually have a lot more information. But I think the other word is actually the bigger thing to think about.
Right, so let's talk about this, because I think the difference between the term culture wars and what you are, and the other euphemisms you're talking about, the war on drugs, the war on terror. In culture wars, the phrase, there's no war on something. It's
yeah.
rather the culture wars, like the
like Star
opium
wars
or Star Wars, right? There's implying it's implying that there are two sides over which culture is being fought, I guess.
Yeah.
But there's no definition of. There's no explicit definition of what side you are on in the deployment of that phrase.
And it's even deeper.
Okay.
It's not even a definition of culture.
Right.
And we can think about this as like big C, little c culture too, right?
Uh-huh.
Are we talking about culture like, are you reading the Iliad in Greek in your seminar? Is
uh-huh.
that culture? It's a capital C? Or are we talking about culture like little c, like I'm third generation Scots, Irish, and German. Everyone has a culture. Culture is just like mixed into the food and the music and sort of ubiquitous in this way.
Okay, great. So can I go on a little thing now?
Please,
because
please
I have some ideas about this. So I'm teaching a class about punk rock right now, which is going to become relevant in a second. But first off, I want to go back to last fall. When I was teaching a class about the presidential election. Yeah, exactly. So, one thing that we talked about in that class, the class about presidential politics and political rhetoric, was how one of the major kind of powers that a president has is the power of definition, right? A president is able to define something as, for example, the war on drugs or the war on terror, and that becomes a thing, right? Because the president said so. And so this was particularly appreciable in the 80s with Reagan. Like, Reagan was, like, very, 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 very good at this. And, for instance, one of the things that Reagan did was really kind of establish a lockhold on religious language and talk about faith and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting mm-hmm. is that Reagan was not the first person to really do that. And you might think, oh, the first person to talk about religion and faith and all that stuff was probably, one of the founding fathers
right.
or president in the 18th and 19th century. But that's actually not the case.
What?
Really, the first president who really regularly talked about his own faith and religion was Jimmy Carter, who's also seen now as kind of being one of the more liberal or progressive presidents we've ever had. And, of course, Jimmy Carter famously lost to Reagan in 1980, but it was really Reagan, at the moment that Jimmy Carter was talking about his faith, the religious right was kind of realizing, like, oh, wow, like, we can do this. This is allowed. Like, church and state, let's throw that out the window. Let's, like, really be political in our takeover of American culture, whatever. So that's one thing, the kind of emergence of a religious space in the American political process. Obviously, prior to the 1980s, there was plenty of influence of religion, but in the 1980s, Reagan kind of opened this window for Jimmy Carter did, for that to be...
The Overton window?
The Overton window, exactly. So that's one thing. That's the presence class. And then the second thing is a little kind of case study in the culture wars happening. One of the things that we were talking about in my class yesterday was Robert Mapplethorpe's photography, because we just read Just Kids, which is Patti Smith's memoir about her life with Robert Mapplethorpe. Are you familiar with his photographs at all, Toby?
No, can you describe one?
So Robert Mapplethorpe did a lot of things, but he is especially known for doing male nudes, especially of the very kind of homoerotic and sadomasochistic variety. I have a couple right here. I'll just show you.
Oh, yeah.
Is
that a gimp?
I'm not sure, but it is a man who is appearing, he's bent over, dressed head to toe, literally in a either leather or latex outfit. It's hard to tell which. Here's a very classic kind of 19th century portrait of a man and his wife, really. But it's, instead of a wife, it's another man. They're both in leather and they're chained together. This is famous one. This too, right? And this is very typical. So anyway, these are all very homoerotic, very sadomasochistic photographs. And in 1989, which was the year that Robert Mapplethorpe died of AIDS, the Institute for Contemporary Art in Philadelphia received a pretty large grant from the National Endowment of the Arts to have an exhibition of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs at the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C. And there was a lot of stuff going on at that time in terms of political involvement in the NEA and the NEH and stuff like that. I think that was around the time that Lynn Cheney was the director of the National Endowment of the Humanities. So anyway, this was in the middle of the culture wars, right?
Right.
And what ended up happening is once the content of this exhibition was revealed, the ICA and the Corcoran Gallery kind of freaked out and they canceled the show. And
right.
this resulted in a huge controversy because it started getting press and religious and conservative organizations started speaking up about it. And one such organization, the American Family Association, referred to the Mapplethorpe photography as, quote, nothing more than the sensational presentation of potentially obscene material. And it turned out that later the courts ruled that no, this is in fact not obscene. But again, there's the emergence of this idea that maybe Nick can talk about a little bit more, the taxpayer, right? And the idea that the customer is always right, right? And that the NEA, which is a federal agency funded by taxpayer money, should not be giving money to things that a certain portion of the taxpayers, the electorate, whatever, does not approve of. So anyway, in sort of conclusion, maybe pass the baton to Nick a little bit, I think what is interesting about this and what we talked about in my class yesterday was that the presumption of the culture wars is that there are multiple cultures in America, most namely really two, which is a more or less progressive, liberal, multicultural, diverse, tolerant of alternative sexualities or lifestyles or what have you culture. And then there's a more traditional, quote unquote, family values, Judeo-Christian, heterosexual, white European culture, and that those two cultures are at war with each other. And I think what's interesting, I mean, I think in these Robert Mapplethorpe photographs, there's a lot of things going on, but one of the things that's going on is that there's, I think, a kind of anthropological or documentary aspect to these photographs that Mapplethorpe is saying, okay, you know, as much as you see yourself as a part of American culture, this is also a part of American culture, right? This exists. Right. I'm taking photographs of it. This isn't all coming from my imagination, right? This is a community or communities.
Yeah.
Right? So I think one of the problems I have with culture wars as a term is this supposition that there are two cultures, right? I think that a better way of thinking about American culture is either as one very kind of multivalent culture, right? Or as a kind of infinite number of cultures that are, you know, grouped together as being American in more or less tenuous ways.
I mean, what you're saying about this, I mean, the role of the taxpayer inside of this arena of the culture war is that there's this fundamental misrecognition going on in the culture wars. That the American Family Foundation is having an aesthetic argument, but they don't imagine they're having an aesthetic argument with Mapplethorpe's photos, for example. So the taxpayer is constructed in the 60s and 70s by the GOP as a way of winning over middle-class voters who are still imagine their political activity as being sanctioned by the New Deal from the 30s and 40s. And so very slowly through the late 40s, as the new left is kind of eroded away by post-World War II American politics, you've got Eisenhower, even before Reagan, right? You've got Eisenhower before Carter putting Under God into the Pledge of Allegiance in the mid-50s. So you have this slow kind of movement towards what becomes the culture wars of the 80s, where Reagan is a kind of major player in that discourse.
It's interesting, too, that Eisenhower is a Jehovah's Witness also.
Oh,
and
wow,
so he was, like, kind of outside, slightly right. out of kind of mainstream American Christianity, and that's how God slipped in there, which is...
Oh, that's pretty cunning.
Yeah.
It is. But nevertheless, right, the taxpayers across the board religiously, right? So the taxpayer becomes this consumer of culture and someone who now has the responsibility to sanction certain areas of culture because their individual money, their working class values now have to be imbued in whatever government programs fund. So what do you fund then? I mean, what kind of art would you fund? You would only fund art that is socially or morally sanctioned under some sort of rubric. And the rubric would have to be what's beautiful, right? This kind of classic aesthetic idea of beauty. Obviously, under that construction, Mapplethorpe isn't sanctioned.
This is one of the things that I talked about with my students, though, is that, like, you know, what I asked them is, are these photographs intended to shock? And I think that it's easy to immediately, it's easy to be shocked by them, but I don't think that's what Mapplethorpe is trying to do. I think that he is trying to invite you to kind of see the beauty in them, right? If not just in terms of the composition, or like these, he's always talking about these deep black colors or whatever, but just kind of, there is love here, right?
Well, so the depth of texture in the Mapplethorpe photo, we're looking right now at the one where the two men are in the living room. It's like a kind of typical American living room, but there's all these things that juxtapose against those social conventions. That there's a deep texture of feeling there, and you want to say, like, that juxtaposition is felt and real.
Yeah.
Right? And then what you're saying is it has presence in American culture. You can't just imagine it away. Well, I want to make a huge leap and go all the way back to Horace.
Uh-huh.
Nice. Great. That's the leap. That's the leap.
I want to say, like, I'm interested in how culture wars are animated in conversations about the arts. And if you go back to Ars Poetica, which is Horace's kind of seminal text, 10 BC, right, this is before the birth of Christ, Ars Poetica is this series of letters that Horace writes to a young poet, essentially. And he says this thing, he says that those artists who want to give fantastic variety to their single theme paint a dolphin in their woods. But you writers should stick to the themes you are familiar with. So meaning that if you don't have, if you have one thing to write about, it's kind of like write what you know, right? If you're trying to do much to provoke, to shock, you put a dolphin in the woods, right? You create a juxtaposition that's like surreal. It's not representative of this world. It's not mimetic. It's not what everyone sees on an everyday basis and therefore agrees with. I mean, right there in 10 BC, you have Horace distinguishing between there's art that can be sanctioned and there's art that's not sanctioned because it's not what we see. It's not what we recognize together. And that division moves, you know, we've inherited that division aesthetically. But we've learned to not recognize it as aesthetic, because all through the 20th century, you have this history of artists who are saying that art doesn't have a link with politics. And a lot of surprising people are actually saying that. I mean, Wallace Stevens, for example, a poet who's associated with a kind of progressive aesthetic, at least, but there's a merging of politics and art there that seems forward-thinking because it's based on the imagination. But he says in an essay in his famous book of prose, I'm expected to say something about the role of the poet in the social or the sociological. He says, point blank, he has none. That there's no relationship between art and politics. And in some way, it's this reaction to the new left in the 30s and 40s that Stevens having. But that gets picked up, even though Stevens doesn't intend it to, by people like Alan Tate, who's a leader of the New Criticism in the 1940s and 50s, where Tate says New Criticism intends to separate an intelligent sector of the American public from political interest, and says that's the goal of New Criticism. And when New Criticism becomes enshrined as the kind of the architecture of how we talk about literature and academia, then you're getting a whole generation of thinkers underneath that rubric where they can't imagine Mapplethorpe, for example, as being art, because art and politics are intimately separated. And so there's this whole misrecognition that's been built into our culture about how we actually talk about what culture is in the first place, where politics and art are not intimate anymore. They're vastly different arenas.
Well, and I think the one thing that's really funny that's related to that is that if you look at the kind of legal definition and battles over obscenity over the course of the 20th century, what obscenity is ultimately revealed to be is just an aesthetic category, right? It's presented initially as a kind of moral or ethical or political category, and through subsequent court trials, you know, with Henry Miller, with Allen Ginsberg or William Burroughs or whatever, what you are left with is just that the obscene is an aesthetic, and you can't make judicial rules about an aesthetic. You know,
it would almost, I think Horace would say the dolphin in the woods is obscene. It's obscene because it's not imaginable.
So, and just to jump in, because I think some of these words are really big, and that strikes me as one of the essential problems of the culture wars as a term and as a concept. Like, it's deployed in any number of different arenas, like the social, the political, the aesthetic, culture, whatever. That, like, in some ways, these are like terms that are so bloated as to be utterly useless for actually identifying a particular issue or moment that you're interacting with.
Well, and I mean, this is an important point too, because I think a part of what is going on with the culture wars, and part of the reason that it's being talked about in the news all the time now, is that at its core is a kind of dividedness, right? And specifically it's that there are two sides that aren't able to have a conversation with each other, right? Which is usually, you know, what war results from.
But you could also just call that culture.
Right. Yeah.
Like when the U.S. had slavery, for example,
right.
And perhaps there were sides that couldn't speak to each other,
right.
They didn't call that, like, a culture war.
And I think what the culture war is a term or as a historical designation or something is denying is the fact that, like, American culture has always very, very much been
that
way.
And every culture, because that's what cultures do.
Exactly.
But, and so what I wanted to pin this to, especially because I think Horace is such a nice way, because we're all divided along wood dolphins, and this is something we give a lot of thought to.
As long as the dolphin is wearing leather and shoes.
yeah, that's good. if our listeners want to, like, see a little culture war at home somewhere, the two places that I think is relatively easy to see it, certainly for academics, but I think for the increasing population of people who go to college or interact with colleges in particular ways, and this is something I grabbed from our former colleague Ian Afflerbeck, is the problem of the syllabus. What gets included in a syllabus in a class? What gets left out?
Sure.
Is it like the best of what we have ever thought and known? It, you know, sort of scare quotes for that. Should it be like Horace? Should it be Shakespeare? Should it be Milton? A long list of dead white men, this sort of thing? Or, like, do you have to include all the sort of cultural stakeholders in your nation inside of your syllabus? Like, should there be, like, a representative of the African American experience, the Asian American experience, female experience in this country? And if so, like, what gets cut out? Because you can only fit so many things in there. And this competition between these various voices and the forms of indoctrination and sort of educational training that happen is, like, the front line of if there is this kind of necessary divide between various groups where these decisions are made.
Yeah, I mean, if there was not a constant level of dissent and conflict, then it's culture probably, or at least culture as we know it, would not exist.
Right, it would be kind of like entropy.
Right.
I mean, as academics, thinking about the syllabus, it's the sides of whatever side you're on. In this context, it's always like it's a canonizing function.
Yeah.
You include this in your syllabus, you don't include this, you're canonizing this and you're excluding this. But for us, I mean, I don't think that's ever our consideration when we're building those spaces, right? They're critical spaces that you're building. They're spaces for critique and not spaces for canonization. And that's I think, where academia comes in, or, you know, we come in, or people like us come in and say, well, it's not always this or that, obviously. These dichotomies are wearing us down. They're eroding this discourse. So what do you do to add to that? To throw it all up in the air, even, right? That you don't have to draw these sharp lines. You can just hang out with these differences. And that's the hard thing for people. People don't want to hang out with all these differences.
Well, and I would even push it further, where, like, the character of academia as a place where you hang out is under, like, constant and concentrated assault, right? Like, academia increasingly is being measured by metrics as, like, how much money do people make mm-hmm. when they graduate? How much giving do alumni make back to the university? What percentage of graduates are employed in what amount of time? And so at that point, the hangout model is depicted as this sort of useless thing.
But I think coming back to something Nick just said, like, if there is, in fact, something that the culture wars are being fought over, I think it is this very idea of difference. I think that basically, and this goes back to the, you know, the beginnings of America, right? I think that there are people that are okay with difference and embrace difference and like difference, and there are people that do not like that. And really, if the culture wars is as a term useful describing anything, I think it is essentially that.
Hmm. I don't know. I'm not comfortable with that binary either, right? Because, I mean, there were really, really puritanical abolitionists.
Sure.
Who were like, difference is okay, everyone must agree with us, that difference is good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they are unified fronts, right? I don't think that everyone who embraces difference is on the same side as everyone else, or, you know, vice versa. But I do think that if there is a dividing line, it is that. I mean, just thinking about history of, like, philosophy, too, like, one of the things that was happening at the same time that the culture wars was becoming a thing, or at least a phrase, is kind of the advent of, like, postmodernism through, like, French theory in particular, right? Which is all about difference, right? It's, I mean, it is essentially, if it is a philosophy of anything, it is a philosophy
Wait,
do
you mean difference or do you mean difference?
I well, both, right? Yeah.
Sorry, Derrida joke is a really good one.
It was requisite.
Two people will laugh.
Yeah. I'm sure there are more out there.
God. Don't know if this goes too far into
it can't go too far. Go,
but
go.
I wonder though if there's more of a it's more fundamental difference. And I started to think about this because last time we recorded, we talked about Matthew Arnold a little bit. And Matthew Arnold is kind of early player in the culture wars, in the 1850s and 60s in England. And what Matthew Arnold does in this essay, The Function of Criticism at the Present Time, is he makes this distinction between pragmatic bourgeois English thinking and reckless French feeling.
Yeah.
And what he's doing is holding up poets like Tennyson, whose poems create these kind of like literary dioramas of 19th century English industrial culture, which is our inheritance, right, in some way. And then on the other side, you have the reckless French feeling people.
Yeah, libertines.
Right, like Rimbaud and Baudelaire, who Arnold never even mentions by name. And you have a whole lineage of American artists who inherit the English literature, right? English literature only recently becomes American literature in a lot of ways. And so us as people who have come up out of English departments or English department-like spaces, then this difference between thinking and feeling is something that we haven't really reckoned with in universities. And I think that the American Family Foundation thinks that they're thinking clearly, and what they're doing is thinking, and they want culture to be pragmatic and rational. And then on the other side, you have people who are having feelings, and that feelings, they get mischaracterized as, you know, hard on your sleeves, like, you know, liberal kind of,
yeah,
you know, out there, like crying, social justice warrior.
But what's ironic is that the American Family Association or whatever, they're not thinking loud. They're feeling. It's pure emotion, right? When they look at this, this freaks them out. Especially, and I'm referring to the Robert Mapplethorpe photographs, especially at the height of the AIDS crisis, where there's a false causality going on, that, like, if you participate in this lifestyle, you're going to die of this, you know, maligned and misunderstood disease, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not operating on a logical basis at all. It's all, you know, pathos.
But what they want out of art is a pragmatic utilitarian, right? This is not pragmatic or utilitarian.
Sure.
So they don't see a use to it. There's no point to it because of that. I don't disagree that
they
obviously have a huge emotional reaction.
Right.
To it. But it's like falling back on this idea of what art should be or what culture should do for us.
Well,
which is a
and
of
but this is where you know, to really get into a critique of the Christian right, like that, what is happening there is they're trying to establish a system that completely denies emotion, right? But it's in the effort of repressing feelings and things like that, but what it's coming from a place of feeling, right? Which is why it doesn't really hold up under any real scrutiny. I mean, under, you know, in my
you know what that actually reminds me of is the scene in Donnie Darko where the mom comes to the door and says, I doubt your commitment to sparkle motion. Do you remember this, right? And it's like this kind of like Christian dance group, right? And that, and you know, that's the
right.
That's I think that's it. I think we solved it.
Yeah.
It's just, what is your commitment to sparkle motion?
Right. And just remember that Reagan was the great communicator, but he was a Hollywood actor. He was good at making people feel like he was a real person. And that's how he was president, as he was, you know, successful in Hollywood.
That would be like if in the modern era, like a reality television performer became president.
Right, yeah, but in a much more complicated way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
Wait, can I ask you guys something, because we're talking about Tennyson? How do you guys feel about Gerard Manley Hopkins? Do you have any, like, strong feelings about him?
Yeah, incredible. Yeah.
Is that another podcast?
What kind of feelings?
I have, like, there's a lot of feelings about the sound in his poems, right? I mean, I'm not, like, totally wed to the stories that he tells, but he's completely identifiable in the lineages that surround him. Like, his contemporaries, have little to no relationship with the sonic complexity of his work.
Okay, well, we should talk about this at a later date, because I just have to say, as someone who, you know, has a PhD in English, I really, really hate Gerard Manley Hopkins poems. And I do not get why, like, every anthology of British poetry you look at, there's, like, a poem. So you'll have to convince
this
me
this is a serious cliffhanger.
Yeah.
All those Hopkins fans out there are like,
dum, dum, dum.
Oh man,
give us more manly. The Office Hour is a production of the Britain Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at Georgia Tech. For more information, visit us on the internet at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening.